My next guest was catapulted into the spotlight for being the most influential person in the life of one of her students. From there, the world would get to know what her scholars had known from day one. She has not only influenced the lives of the children at Mott Hall Bridges Academy, the school where she was founding principal, she changed their trajectories. She has shared some of her story on her own podcast and several other media outlets. But hers is a story that even after you hear it, will still be hard to believe. It will inspire you, however, to never stop doing what you were called to do. Coming up next on the 40 Plus Files, global leader, author, speaker, coach, and educator extraordinaire who opened a school to close a prison, Dr. Nadia Lopez. Welcome to the show, Dr. Lopez. How are you?
I am good, Jacqueline. How are you?
I'm doing well. So glad you're joining us on the show today. We have a lot to talk about.
Indeed, we do.
Yes. I have been following you for years on LinkedIn, and you are an agent of change. Let me just, say that.
And Thank you.
You've made a difference in many, many lives. So I'm excited to talk to you today.
I'm excited to have this conversation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, I'm going to start out by asking you a question that I ask all of my guests. Mm-hmm. How did you view aging or growing older when you were in your 20s?
I think about it as aging gracefully. I had the blessing of having my grandmother in my life until she was a month shy of 99. I had, my mom is still in my life. And so I got to see these amazing, strong women grow into what I call their golden saint years. Mm-hmm. And live their full lives, live their best lives. I've never been one to fear the aging process, mm-hmm. but I'm stumped because no one ever has asked me that question, but I think it's an important question because as some parts of we're living longer, but there's also the challenges of how we live, and especially a child who's like the sandwich year kid. Mm-hmm. Like I have a 20-year-old and now I have senior parents. I think no one prepared me mm-hmm. for what that entails. Mm-hmm. Right. And the needs that come with it. So yes, they look graceful. They, growing old gracefully, but there's a tremendous amount of needs, mm-hmm. Preparation in terms of your health, where you're living, and just thinking about what it means to really have community to support mm-hmm. you, whether it's yourself or those who are getting older, because it's not easy.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. You had your grandmother till she was almost 99. That's a blessing. Truly mm-hmm. is. And it really mm-hmm. speaks volumes because I share this a lot, in my writing and just to people in general. I did not have that closeness of a grandmother. My mm-hmm. maternal grandmother passed away when I was 2. And then my father's mom lived till I was 14, but there was no close connection there. So mm-hmm. all the women who've experienced that, I think that is such a blessing. So the show is called The 40 Plus Files. What was your biggest epiphany after turning 40?
That is not the new 20s. That was a lie. I was like, oh, I can't wait to be 40. All the 40 is the new 20. Mm-hmm. I started hearing every crick in my body. I was like, what's happening here? But I also felt like there was a sense of maturity that comes with 40. Like there's things that in your 20s and in your 30s, you just won't accept when you get to your 40s, mm. right? Like your 20s, you're still figuring yourself out. You just finished school or you've entered into a career, wherever you are in your life, but it's still the fun years. It should be the fun years. I ended up getting married and having a child in my 20s. Mm-hmm. So I kind of followed the rote of what society said you should have and mm-hmm. don't feel like I lived my full 20s. Mm. But needless to say, it is that those years where for me, because the millennials live totally different, right? My generation is kind of like, you're following what society standard says you should do at a certain age and try to achieve those things, whether it's your career or your family life. Mm-hmm. And then by your 30s, you realize, okay, I've started to get into the groove of those things, mm-hmm. but I don't know if I'm fully complete, and you're willing to step out and explore a little bit more. But then when you're in your 40s, I feel like this is the year where I'm like, I'm not here for you.
Right.
It's not what you want. It's not what you need. It's what I need. It is what I want. Mm-hmm. And you look at relationships differently. Mm-hmm. You start to really assess the value of people in your lives and how people are valuing you. And I feel like we often speak up about that to folks. Like you're not as willing to let things, I don't want to say let things go, but you're not willing to just say, you know, that's how that person is. It's more mm-hmm. like, I don't have the time and energy to waste on this. Mm-hmm. I just don't, because you realize where you really are in your life. Mm-hmm. Like I have a child who's 20. If you are a friend or even a family member and you got too much drama, I cannot, because mm-hmm. I'm mm-hmm. raising this child over here who's now yeah. an adult. You need to figure out your stuff. I could be a friend. I could be supportive, but I can't put in all the time and energy into this. Mm-hmm. You know, and I also feel like I'm at a place in the 40s of, I feel like you start to realize the second chapter of your life.
Mm-hmm. For sure.
Right. Like yep. now you're valuing every moment of your life because you realize age is starting to hit mm-hmm. differently.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I can't stay out in the clubs like I did back in the 30s and 20s. I can't do that. Mm-hmm. I can't do it. I need more time to sleep. I need to focus on my health, you know, eating good, being well to myself. I need to reevaluate this workspace. And so I enjoy the 40s so.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's a whole new illumination. I always say at 30, you know, I think a light bulb comes on. At 40, there's a whole new illumination, right? Mm-hmm. So that's definitely true for most people. So now you are, you know, of course, known to be this rock star educator, because I know that's one of your things here in the U.S. Educators are not considered to be rock stars.
Yeah.
Watching you over the years, you're a rock star in my book. Okay.
Thank you.
But education was not your first career choice. So talk about what your original career plans were when you graduated from college.
My original career plan was to become a nurse. Mm-hmm. That's what, I've always had a love for science. In my high school, I was part of what's called the Macy Medical Program. And so it put me on a pathway of focusing on healthcare and the sciences. I even worked for the Department of Health and focused on HIV program services, you know, to really support our community, especially Black and Brown communities where the numbers are disparaging as comparison to our counterparts. But once I graduated and, you know, I took my NCLEX, I was just not interested in doing that. And I realized it during my journey in college, but didn't know what else I could do. Mm-hmm. And I will say this, I had to deal with a lot of the pressure that came from my mom, who was a nurse's assistant, who felt like she was living through me. And so she wanted me to be a nurse. She didn't want me to have to take orders. Mm-hmm. And I understand that. I understand that. And as a parent, we want our children to be better than us. Mm-hmm. But there was some imposing of what you want and not really valuing when I said, this is not, I don't see myself doing this mm-hmm. because nursing is a phenomenal career. However, it wasn't my calling. Mm-hmm. I felt like I wanted to be connected to people longer. And I was always interested in talking to people and learning about them. And when they would come to the hospital, the thing that you learn is how to ask good questions and to provide holistic care. Mm-hmm. And so it's not about the diagnosis, it's about the behaviors that led to the diagnosis. It's understanding the person's background so that you can give them the strategies or ways in which you can educate them for them to make better decisions about their health. Mm-hmm. But you have a short amount of time to deal with that person.
Right.
And I really, really love critical care. But as you know, critical care is like almost like ICU, right? Intensive care, where the person is literally their lives are on the line. Mm-hmm. But I loved it because you learn so much and you got to do so much. But I didn't want to always have to interact with people when their lives were on the line. Mm. So I decided that nursing wasn't the thing for me. And I didn't want to step into a career working in a hospital, knowing that my heart wasn't in it. And there are people whose livelihood depended on me. Because I feel like when you're not passionate about something, especially when it comes to healthcare, you literally can be the life or death of someone. And you can't make mistakes, and your mistakes are tied to your license, and your license is your livelihood. So I didn't want that for myself, and I don't want that for a patient. So I decided I'm going to work for Verizon, a phone company. Mm-hmm. I know that people will be like, how did she go from one to the other? Verizon was paying really good. Mm-hmm. You got a paycheck every week. The benefits were exceptional. Mm-hmm. And I could go back to school at their expense. Mm. So I thought maybe I would want to go into the business field, get my MBA. They were willing to pay for it outright. Mm-hmm. And so I started to take graduate classes towards my MBA. But quickly I realized, one, I didn't really care for, I worked in account collections, but I also was working on a lot of fraud cases. Mm-hmm. And that wasn't my thing. Like, it was good, but, and the pay was great, but it wasn't fulfilling. I didn't feel like this was my purpose. And I always thought about my daughter and the fact that one day, you know, I would tell her to pursue something that she was passionate about. Mm-hmm. And then she would tell me that I settled by working for the phone company, which is nothing wrong with the phone company, but knowing who I am and what I want out of my life, she would then, I knew, because the way I was as a kid, I knew my daughter would throw it right in my face, like, but you settled, so why are you stressing me? Mm-hmm. And so I didn't want to embody that. Mm-hmm. And so, and you also, you know, you start to get jaded at your job because it just becomes about the money, and the money wasn't as much as good as it wasn't making me happy. Mm. And so I thought about what career would make sense. You did nursing, you did public health, you did retail, you're doing telecommunications. What makes sense? And then I would just think about my daughter, and I talked to people about the schools that they chose for their kids. And then they would just talk about how horrible the experience was and mm-hmm. these teachers and blah, 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 blah. And I was like, what? I had a great educational experience in New York City public schools. Mm-hmm. And then I was like, I think I want to be a teacher, because I remember I had some really fantastic teachers. Mm-hmm. And that's how I ended up in education. It was really my daughter and thinking about who would have the most influence outside of me, because that was the same that happened for me with my household. My parents, they were great, but they trusted the school system and they trusted the educators who I sat in front of every single day. And so I wanted that. And that's how I ended up in education.
Wow. You know, I think we came up in a different time, because I'm a product of Chicago public schools. And now I think a lot of people have, you know, things to say about the public school system, because times have changed. Mm-hmm. But so how do you think your background and working with people at Verizon, how do you think that prepared you for your career in education?
Working for Verizon made me realize, you know, customer service is key. Mm-hmm. And because I worked in account collections, it was a hostile environment, because you're literally dealing with people whose phones are either cut off, or the fact that this person financially is not secure and they're struggling to pay their bills and they're having to make payment arrangements, mm-hmm. right? And for many people, that it, the interaction can make you feel like it lacks dignity. Mm-hmm. And so when people would get on the phone and the first thing they started to do was curse me out because their phone is cut off, right? Mm-hmm. As, you know, what's interesting is that person is trying to inflict harm on me by speaking to me in a derogatory manner. Mm-hmm. And in my mind, I'm like, I'm at work getting my check. You mad at me because you didn't pay your bill. Mm-hmm. Right. That's my reaction. Mm-hmm. But I had to sit with it, understanding that they're not mad at me. They're mad at their circumstance. Mm-hmm. They're mad that they even have to call. Right. And I am now the face or the voice that has caused them pain and trauma and has embarrassed them in a way that they don't have the opportunity to, you know, say, I can't afford this. I need to make the arrangements before my phone gets cut off. Mm-hmm. Now they're mad that they're in this situation. They have to pay a reconnection fee. They have to, you know, and they feel like they're begging me for something that they are entitled to, mm-hmm. but you got to pay for it. And so when I became a teacher and then later a principal if parents came into my office and they were upset, or they call me and they are, you know, using every profanity in the book, mm-hmm. I know they're not upset with me per se. They're right. upset with the circumstance. And so I got to get to the root of the circumstance and now say to them, I want to be able to assist you. Mm-hmm. So let's talk and come in if you want to, or let's make a plan. But I can't take it personal because it's bigger than me. Like, their circumstances are much bigger than me. So yeah. that was the first thing. The second thing was being a nurse and going through that process. You are holistic. You look at the whole person. Mm-hmm. You don't just look at the individual based off of their disease. You look at them as, where do they come from? What needs do they have? What resources are available? How are we helping them, you know, mm-hmm. and really getting to the heart of the matter. And so when working in communities that have been impoverished and you know that marginalized folks who are living in the quote unquote poverty situations, that's not their fault, mm-hmm. right? Like mm-hmm. it's much bigger than them. You have to look at the community. You have to look at how they have been deprived of mm-hmm. basic human rights. You have to look at the housing develops that they live in, right? We know that there's a lot of homes that have lead that they haven't, they know that lead exists, but they're not fixing it. During the wintertime, they don't have heat. They don't have proper running water. They wake up and they go to the corner store, and the first thing they open up in the refrigerator of the store is the beer section. There's no, you know, the water is way in the back. Mm-hmm. Like, it's set up and designed mm-hmm. for us to fail or to engage in these behaviors that are unhealthy. But people who don't know our community or never actually break down what's happening mm-hmm. judge us based off of our actions and not how things are set up for us to conform to what's occurring. Mm-hmm. So those two things helped me and informed me as an educator. You are here in service of others, and don't take anything personal, mm-hmm. even when they come for you.
Right.
And to be very mindful, ask the right questions and understand that there is an underlying problem and your job is to come up with the solution.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Now, you said that you were prepared to be in a space of education with your eyes wide open. Mm-hmm. What is your take on how Black educators deal with Black students? And you said students were programmed to believe that they were not good enough. Mm-hmm. You know, so kind of elaborate on that a little bit, because I think that having been an educator myself for a number of years, and I've been in environments like that. So talk a little bit about that.
Black educators already come with background knowledge, which is really important. Mm-hmm. Cultural background knowledge. Now I want to be very clear when I say this. Mm-hmm. Not all skin folk and kin folk. We have to be clear about that. Because as a principal, I was challenged with folks who are Black but come from affluent backgrounds and questioned like why children are acting a certain way without realizing their own personal biases. Mm-hmm. I've had to deal with Black educators who backgrounds come from outside countries, right, including myself, mm-hmm. and not realizing that the ways in which our families and our cultures look at education and prioritizing education isn't necessarily what we see mm-hmm. in many of our communities in the United States, and having to have them unlearn that without coming with prejudices. But overall, we understand the importance of education. We understand the importance of making sure that children feel accepted, wanted, and to always have high expectations of them, mm-hmm. right? Like, we are willing to step in and have those hard conversations and remind them of why their behaviors are inappropriate and how it could affect them long-term. We are very clear on why, if something is difficult, they need to be able to share with someone that they trust, and why education has to be at the forefront, right? Mm-hmm. We're very clear on that. So what I would say is that we don't allow young people to get away with the shenanigans. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We're going to pull you in and have those hard conversations. And I think that it's important to give platforms to Black educators to share their experiences. Mm-hmm. And also in spaces where we're not dominant, whether it's, you know, in leadership or in the classroom as it relates to young people, because we know that there is a higher percentage of white teachers and white administrators in our schools, mm-hmm. but they don't understand cultural competencies, right? Mm-hmm. And cultural competencies has nothing to do with what we're learning inside of a textbook. Mm-hmm. It's understanding that when you think Little Miss, I'm going to just give a name. Keisha comes in and she's upset today, mm-hmm. right? She came straight in the door and she is livid and upset. And you take it as she's rolling the eyes. She's sucking her teeth. You're taking offense to it. And then when you start to say to her, that's not how we talk to people. And she's like, well, that's how I'm talking to you today, right? Well, you'll be suspended and you put her to the side, as opposed to, so I already see this. You having a hard day. Mm-hmm. I'm going to have you go into my office, mm-hmm. or you call on somebody else to talk to this child or put them in the room. And then you give them 20 minutes just for them to sit in silence by, you know, like without anyone interacting with them. And then you sit with them one-on-one outside of being in front of others, and you pay attention and you say, I noticed that you're not having a good day. Mm-hmm. Is there anything I can do to help you? Giving them a sheet of paper and saying, I know you may not want to talk, but maybe mm-hmm. you could write this down and tell me what's going on. Mm-hmm. Or pay attention to how they're dressed. Are they coming in neatly attired? Mm-hmm. Right. Half of the times my girls, first thing in the morning, if they was live, I had to look at their hair. If the edges was not laid, mm-hmm. it was a problem. Mm. Because they would, you know, make fun of each other. Right. And so the anticipation that someone's going to say something, you come in rah-rah because you don't want somebody to say something to you. So your anger is trying to, you know, be projected onto someone else so no one comes at you.
Wow.
So we just got to lean in. And I would, you know, tell people all the time, I used to have headbands in my drawer. Mm-hmm. I used to have, my teachers had gel and brushes, mm-hmm. right? And we would make sure, like, go in the bathroom, take one of these, make sure you look good. Mm-hmm. Or the child who didn't eat. They woke up, had to take their 3 or 4 brothers and sisters to school before they could get to school, and they're hungry and they can't say, I'm hungry. I had all type of snacks. My guidance counselor would bring stuff every morning and we would say, just go ahead and eat some cereal, have a bagel. Mm-hmm. You need some water. And I used to have water from my staff because I didn't want them going outside and having to pay for water. I paid for Poland Spring to bring their water in. This is not a paid ad, y'all. Mm-hmm. But I'm just saying that we would have the water. And I would tell the kids, so I have some magical water that will make you feel refreshed. And it's just going to make you feel invigorated. You want some? Because everybody can't have none, honey. And the kids be like, I could have some magical water? Absolutely. You know, and it just made them feel special. Because then all of a sudden, all of them would want water. No, it's magical. Everybody can't have it. Mm-hmm. That would set their day off better. We understand, because a lot of us have gone through those same circumstances and we understand the importance of being seen and being heard. Mm-hmm. But most importantly, creating those spaces where children feel safe enough and valued and mm-hmm. not judged.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Wow. Now, I know that you started out when you began teaching in special ed. What was significant about taking your students over the Brooklyn Bridge, and you were in areas where, you know, that are considered, I wouldn't necessarily say impoverished, but
there's a lot of economic disparities.
Yes, 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 mm-hmm. yes. What was significant about taking them out of their comfort zone and just over something as simple as taking them over the Brooklyn Bridge?
Well, I learned this from my co-teacher, Julia Dakota, because this first school that I worked at was literally maybe 6 or 7 blocks from the Brooklyn Bridge. And as a kid born and raised in Brooklyn, my parents constantly had me traveling throughout New York City, right? We had, back then we had tokens before we had Metro cards. We were literally like the city was our playground. Mm. And it was just interesting to me that many of my scholars had not left a 4-block radius, or all they knew was the immediacy of their neighborhood. Mm-hmm. But if I spoke about different parts of Manhattan, I spoke about Queens or the Bronx, they looked at me like I was talking about foreign places. Mm. And so the Brooklyn Bridge is iconic, right? Like when people come to New York, that's the first place they want to go and see and take pictures of. And I'm like, y'all are 6 or 7 blocks away. You've never gone to the Brooklyn Bridge. You've never walked over it. And they were like, no. And Dakota said to me, you know, it's our responsibility to take them to places that they've never seen. and something like this, they believe that they don't deserve or belong across the water. So that's what we need to do. And so I had kids who were in gangs. I had kids who were like, you know, the best of the best when it came to behavior, that you would be like, if Jesus could take the nails again through Calvary, this is what it feels like. But you recognize that a lot of it just comes from their own lack of knowledge, right? And lack of knowledge becomes the ignorance of things. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, they would act tough. They'd be like, oh, we're walking over the Brooklyn Bridge. Like, okay. And then we get to the foot of the bridge and the same tough kids were like, wait, hold on. Is the bridge still going to stand? You know, literally I can't, and shaking. And I was like, wait, what? You afraid? Miss Lopez, hold my hand. I'm like, what happens if I don't hold your hand? Don't do that, Miss Lopez. And like tears in their eyes. And I'm like, I got you. We're good. Uh-huh. And then we went over the Brooklyn Bridge. And the way the cars, like when you have so many cars and they're moving, it vibrates, right? But I'm mm-hmm. like, bridges are suspension, have suspension in them. So we're not gonna go into the water. It's been here over 100 years. And then once we got over, we would go to the South Street Seaport. Mm-hmm. And they had never been there. And they, like these same children, were sitting quietly looking at the Statue of Liberty, watching the boats. But there was such a peace that came over them. And I look at the moment as I didn't realize how much I was privileged, even though my parents weren't rich, but experiences allow you access and opportunities that is a privilege. Mm-hmm. And my own child had been back and forth over the bridge in a car, you know, mm-hmm. to the seaport. Like to her, this would be nothing. If she saw him, she's like, why are you so like excited right. about this? Right. Mm-hmm. But for them, it was like, we had taken a trip to France. Mm. And so they literally said to me, you can come here every day and it's free. And I'm like, yes, it's part of Manhattan, New York City. Like, mm. And, you know, that opened my eyes. So when I opened up my school, Mont Hall Bridges Academy, mm-hmm. one, it was paying homage to my city that I loved, right? Brooklyn mm-hmm. Bridge. Bridging the connection, because mm-hmm. we're all connected to succeed, but making sure that our children understood past, present, and future. And for me, walking over the bridge was connecting you to your future, mm-hmm. to get you beyond your comfort, to get you from the place that you know to the place that you are being afforded an opportunity of seeing the possibilities of life. Mm-hmm. And so it became part of the culture of the school that every year our sixth graders who would come in, we would collectively, sixth grade teachers, administration, and the scholars and their parents were invited to come, and we would walk over the Brooklyn Bridge together. Mm. Because I wanted them to know, you don't forget where you come from Brownsville. Mm-hmm. You just know that you're looking forward to something bigger and better. And when you come back to Brownsville, you need to share this experience so someone else can be able to see what you saw.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Now, you mentioned your school, Mott Hall Bridges Academy.
Yes.
It was opened in the Brownsville area in Brooklyn. Now, I know that that was important to you. What did it mean to you? Now, you had experienced all kinds of things as an educator by the time you opened your own school.
Yeah.
What did it mean to you? And how did you plan to navigate this terrain? Because
So behind the scenes, Jacqueline and I had a conversation. That's why she's like, you've been through all the things.
Right.
And I want to be clear and transparent with people. Because I had been through all the things prior to opening up my school, Brownsville was not the place I wanted to open up my mm-hmm. school, because I've literally experienced the violence of when people don't care and people cause trauma, physical, mental trauma, and how it was very telling to me that there were adults in a school in Brownsville that was doing this to me as another adult. Mm-hmm. Just imagine what it would look like for children. Mm-hmm. And so I was an assistant principal before I became a principal. And then in the school that I was at, the children had gone there from kindergarten or pre-K all the way up until eighth grade. Mm-hmm. Right? There was no transition. It was straight pre-K to eighth grade. But no one ever spoke to them about college. And I just was like, how do we exist as a school and we don't talk to them about college? No one talked to them about the options of high schools. So in New York City, it's not like other places where you go from elementary school, right? Based off of your zip code, you go from this elementary school to this middle school to this high school. Mm-hmm. That's not how it is in New York. You get to choose what middle schools you want to go to, and then you get to choose what high school you want to go to. But if you're in a pre-K through A school, you only make a decision on what high school. And we have over 300 high schools in New York City, right? Maybe 500 and maybe more. But whatever the context is, you have a choice. And our young people in Brownsville did not know of the choices outside of their zone schools. Hmm. So zone schools are your neighborhood schools, mm-hmm. which are more than likely not themed. So it's not focused on medicine. It might not be focused on writing. It's not focused on architecture. It's just where all the neighborhood kids go. And if you make it, you make it. If you don't, oh, well, like that's literally how sometimes they're seen. And so I would talk to my kids about college and they said, we're from Brownsville. We don't go to college. And I was so confused by that.
Wow.
And then when, you know, my eighth graders, we were talking about high schools, they only could tell me about the local school. And I was like, there's amazing schools like Benjamin Banneker, Bedford Academy, like Mega Evers Prep schools that will get you prepared for college, that gets you college credits and you can get a degree, an associate's by the time you graduate. And they looked at me like, yeah, no, that's not where my friends go.
Wow.
And so I started to become a mentor to my young people. And I took 25 students with the help of my friend Marlon Peterson, who had been incarcerated, but had a partnership with Vassar College, upstate New York. And we took 25 young people who thought that they didn't belong there. And it was the most compelling moment of their lives. Because today, 24 out of the 25 went to college.
Wow.
The only one who didn't became a professional soccer player, right? And that was the only reason why. But you would just imagine that was one time we took them on one trip and spoke to them, and they were standing in front of a Black professor, which is Kiese Lamon, who wrote Heavy, right? Mm-hmm. He became a New York Times bestseller after the fact, right? And he had on Air Force One and his tweed jacket and jeans on and was like, and tell me why y'all not going to college. And they came up with, I can't afford it. No one believes in me. All these other things. And he had them do an assignment and they realized like, I can't come. And he was like, there's something called an endowment. And if your parents make less than, and he gave the amount, then you can go to school for free. And they was like, what are you talking about? He was like, yeah. So there really is no excuse. That opened up their eyes. And so, you know, those seeds had also been planted in me about, again, the importance of experiences and exposure and speaking into children, the existence of where they can be and taking them into places where they themselves have had glass ceilings imposed upon them that they can't go. And so, you know, I wanted to make sure that I had a safe school that adults didn't feel like they could ever be injured or yelled at or taken for granted. I wanted a school where children felt like they could be heard and seen, even when they were going through tough times, and that other children would, as peers, you would support and uplift your, you know, your fellow peer or mate, because all they have learned, a lot of them, was to hurt each other through words. So hurt people, hurt people. Our kids were really good at using words that were hurtful and actions that were hurtful. So teaching them other ways of showing up and being inclusive. Like we talk about inclusivity, but really respecting people based off of whoever they choose to be in, as it relates to their identity, as it relates to their race, their creed, their religion. And so my experiences, although they are those that have been very hurtful and very painful, I don't think if I didn't go through those things as an adult, knowing that this is what you can experience in the education system, I would have fought as hard when I became a principal. Like I knew what the kids were up against. And so it was important to me to get the right educators in. And if you weren't the right educator, you can't stay here. I don't have time for you to figure out your stuff or think that it's okay to talk to children in a degrading manner. That's not what you're here for. And you can't earn a check with me hurting children. And so that became the premise. And so as much as I didn't want to open a school in Brownsville, I recognized God chose that through my, you know, what I went through, because then I was truly prepared to provide them with what they needed.
Mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely. And you definitely changed the lives of many of your scholars. Mm-hmm. And you even started to experience a lot as a principal. I mean, you opened up this school, you did all of the, you know, heavy lifting as an educator. It's so ironic that you think that people go into this field of work to make a difference. Mm-hmm. But it's amazing how many people are there just to, they go along to get along.
Yeah.
And they forget that they have these children's lives in their hands. You did not forget.
No.
And when that is the case, unfortunately, you are, it seems that you're fighting an uphill battle, you know. So even though you were in there, you changed the trajectory of a lot of those scholars' lives. You know, what kind of problems that you start to encounter as principal even?
Oh, I became targeted because I was a disruptor. So I mm-hmm. became targeted by the powers that be. I was oftentimes treated in a manner that is, you would never treat children, right? Like the first thing they tell you is, you know, you should not demean or demoralize a child. That's how I was spoken to. You know, the emails that I would receive when I wanted better for my scholars, I was, you know, in emails or in phone calls being told that, you know, your kids aren't, and my school was being compared. So again, I'm a middle school mm-hmm. and I'm being compared to Stuyvesant High School, and Stuyvesant High School is considered one of the top high schools, specialized high schools in New York City, right? Mm-hmm. Those kids are groomed for like the Princetons, the Harvards, and all of the other, mm-hmm. you know, Ivy League schools. And I was told, your school isn't a Stuyvesant, mm-hmm. Principal Lopez. Like, why? Your kids are not going to ever reach that level. And it was interesting because it's the same people who authorized me to open up a school. And mm-hmm. so my question was like, so why did I open up a school if that's how you even feel? And you're speaking to me. So how do I, as someone who has to come in here every day, mm-hmm. fight against every circumstance these children are going through, mm-hmm. prove to them that they can be who they dream of and much more? You're literally using the same words that have marginalized them because you don't want me to think bigger. You don't want me to feel empowered to know that, oh my God, she's changing lives. Mm-hmm. Because for me to do that, I'm changing trajectories, right? I'm literally disrupting the school to prison pipeline. I'm literally messing up people's money, mm-hmm. right? That's and that it. Became an issue. So the goal was, let's drag her and let's prove to her that she can't make it. And that's when self-doubt comes in, right? Because mm-hmm. all of these things, I often hear folks and even myself talk about imposter syndrome. But I also want to say that I feel like there's an imposition disease where there are people who impose upon us how they want us to be limited because they're either insecure or they're threatened by what we're doing. And yes. so if they're constantly telling you otherwise, you start to believe it. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right. And so, you know, I had to deal with that. I had to deal with money being taken out of my budget. So when the Department of Education failed to fulfill the number of children I was supposed to have my first year, it was their fault. They lost a court case against the NAACP when they were closing another school. And because of that, I did not meet the numbers that I was supposed to have because I was supposed to take the kids who from that school come into my school. And they charged me right against my budget. They took $225,000 because I didn't have enough students. And I was like, but that's not my fault. Mm-hmm. Y'all failed to give me the kids. Mm-hmm. Wow. And they said, the reason why we're doing that is because you hired mental health providers. So clearly you're not prioritizing money accordingly. And I said, I hired mental health providers because I couldn't hire a guidance counselor. And they wouldn't let me hire a guidance counselor because they were like, oh, we don't know how this money is going to go. So I needed to get a contract with someone who was going to cost me less, but still provide the services that was needed. Mm-hmm. And they told me that I hadn't prioritized academics and that I was clearly misusing money. Wow. And I said, these children are hurting. And my teachers are suffering through vicarious trauma. I need a mental health provider in here. And they said, well, the choice has been yours. We're taking back this money. Mm-hmm. And now when you look at the Department of Education, the whole push is mental health, mm-hmm. social emotional learning, yeah. blah, 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 blah. And I was like, wow, that's so interesting.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
So a lot of the things that I thought about was way ahead of its time. Mm-hmm. Being a Black woman, a Afro-Latina doing it mm-hmm. in a community that shouldn't be allowed to do this mm-hmm. was disruptive and upsetting to a lot of people because, as you said, by the time my story comes out and it's Humans of New York comes out, people started to look at our school because we had a Facebook page, we had Instagram, and then they were like, wait, she's always been doing this. How come we didn't know about her? So now when people are tapping, you know, tapping my brain or like asking me, how were you able to do like provide your kids with mental health and your staff from the time you opened up the school? I was like, yeah, since 2010. Well, why aren't all schools doing this? Mm. How is it that you were taking your kids to different colleges and universities and even hosting your own a college fair at a middle school level? Mm-hmm. Why aren't all colleges doing this? So I was doing all of these things before the notoriety came, and it made people really even more uncomfortable. So while folks would think, oh, you got on this platform, you became quote unquote a celebrity principal, mm-hmm. I was scrutinized even further. Mm-hmm. Right? Yes. Yeah. And no one prepares us for what it's like to be in the limelight. No one prepares you for what it's like to have to deal with criticism, you know, and it came from Black folks the mm-hmm. most, right? Mm-hmm. And that was what was disheartening. And then there were other people in the media who would say to me, why do you call them scholars? Do you not see that they couldn't achieve to the highest success like their, you know, other kids? And I said, because that's my business. Mm. You know, I call them scholars because I want them to be reminded that no matter where they are in this world, they don't have to be in school to learn. Mm. We keep telling children the only time that they learn is when they're in school. Pay attention when you're in school. Learn when you're in school. But when they step out of school, they should still be learning.
Yeah.
When they go on the train and go to it somewhere else, you should still learn. Absolutely. So I had to change the language and I had to call them as I saw them, as scholars. Mm-hmm. And when people say, well, that's not how the word is supposed to be used. I didn't ask you how anybody chose any word to be used. I'm telling you how I'm using it. Mm-hmm. I didn't ask your permission. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. so sometimes we have to do that. And the way I speak is not to be disrespectful. It's just that I have to stand in my truth and my power. Mm-hmm. And God called me to do this work. Mm-hmm. So unless he's the one who sends a message or is very clear on what I'm supposed to be doing otherwise, I don't need you to explain nothing to me because I got here by him, not by you. Mm. And so, you know, I trust and know that my ancestors, they fought and died many times so that I could stand here and do what I'm doing, mm-hmm. right? And when we talk about our Black children and our brown children not being able to read and write, but we know that slaves were able to learn how to read the Bible, you can't tell me that a child in a country that's supposed to be quote unquote free, where mm-hmm. we know that there's some limitations to that, mm-hmm. that has more opportunities, can't learn to read and write. It's all about how our schools are designed and set up to fail our children. Mm. Right. Because there was no school when they were learning the Bible. It was literally someone, a white woman or white male who sat with them and read to them. Mm-hmm. So the question is, why aren't we engaging our schools where kids are just reading along with the teacher mm-hmm. instead of preparing them for tests all day, every day? Mm-hmm. Reading to children changes how they read and write and how they comprehend. Mm-hmm. But we have so many parents who they themselves went through an education system who may not have the skills, who may be illiterate, who can't read to their kids at home. And the first time they start reading is when they get to school.
Yeah. Yeah.
So all of these things, me speaking up and speaking out the way I speak, many of y'all be like, oh, is she angry? No, I'm passionate mm-hmm. because I know that we can change the game. I know that inequities is a decision and a choice that has been made.
Yep.
For specific neighborhoods, mm-hmm. right? We know what the problems are. We've seen the research. It's repeated, 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 repeated. And we know the definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over again. It is insane that we keep talking and speaking about the problems, but what are we going to do differently? Mm-hmm. And so my school represented what we were going to do differently. And because of that, my kids ended up going to college. My kids ended up starting businesses. Because I made it a priority that every single child who went to Mott Hall in seventh grade had to take an entrepreneurship program for an entire year. Mm-hmm. I made sure that my adults had mental health services. I made sure that the families had mental health services, that we did art therapy. Mm-hmm. I made sure my kids were exposed to so much African drumming, African dance, videography, music production, you know, anything that their hearts desire, photography. fashion design. And then I brought people from all walks of life who would never step foot in Brownsville, who were celebrities themselves. And I said to them, I know y'all are celebrity, but my kids are stars. Mm. And I want you to meet them.
Yes. Your school started to get all of this attention. And, mm-hmm. you know, after the Humans of New York article was published, how did that sort of start you on this downward spiral? Something that should have been a pinnacle in your life. You know, you got this attention because you did these great things and you mm-hmm. changed these students' lives. Why do you think that started, you know, you on this downward spiral?
Well, here's the thing. Up until that time, I was still struggling. I was struggling in terms of my mental health and my physical health. So I was dealing with depression. I was dealing with anxiety, all related to work. Mm-hmm. Just the depression of we're not where I feel like we should be because of the circumstances that we're up against. The anxiety of every time I looked, there was another compliance. There was another demand. There was another something. Like constantly all the evaluation. So you never felt like, for me, I never felt like I was achieving or being successful, even though if you look at the way our kids were progressing, they mm-hmm. were, mm-hmm. but I never heard anyone say to me, you're doing a good job. That never came from the people that evaluated me. Right. Mm-hmm. And I won't say it never came from, I did have a superintendent, mm-hmm. Dr. DeGavaya, Maura DeGavaya, who was very supportive, but I have four superintendents in my tenure as a principal. Mm-hmm. This one person was only there for a couple of years. Everyone else that I had was never really supportive. So just like with children, if you don't hear mm-hmm. that you're doing something well, if you don't feel like, and it's not about praise to, you know, make a person's ego rise, but it's just a simple acknowledgement that mm-hmm. I'm doing something good. Yes. Yeah. I was constantly made to feel like, yeah, you did that, but it's not good enough. Mm. Right. And then by the time, right before Humans of New York, I wanted to quit. I was just exhausted. Mm-hmm. I had been putting in 16, 17 hour days. Literally, I would get to work at 7. I would leave work at midnight. Like literally, like those janitors would be like, Dr. Lopez, wow. I need you to go. mm-hmm. And I'm like, just a little bit more. I was going to work Saturday and Sunday. My janitor would open up the door for me on Sunday after church, leave me in the school, come back, right? Like he would do whatever mm-hmm. he needed to, but he only had to be in the building, let's say 4 hours. I was in there 8 to 10 hours on a Sunday, right? Wow. Mm-hmm. So all of these things was happening. So I'm internalizing everything. So I developed acid reflux, right? And the acid reflux was so bad mm-hmm. that it started to affect my esophagus in a way that I developed eosinophilic esophagitis, mm-hmm. which is your white blood cells attacking your esophagus. Mm-hmm. I would go to the emergency room, have to drink liquid lidocaine. Like it's crazy, right? Mm-hmm. I get on this medication. I have to be on medication for a while. And then eventually I developed kidney disease. Mm-hmm. But all throughout this time, I kept telling folks, this is overwhelming. I'm tired. I'm exhausted. You know, it's a lot of stress. Mm-hmm. And there was no intervention. I would hear things like, you need to go and do exercise, like exercise. And I'm like, exercise? I don't want to exercise. So I say all of that because one, as a Black woman, I put on my superhero cape mm-hmm. because I knew that I had to do all things if I wanted anything to change. Right. Mm-hmm. But when we put on these superhero capes, we also are messaging to people that we don't need help. And even when we're hurting, when it's that word, like if we say no, but we're still acting in the word yes, people don't respect the word no. Mm. So people kept just asking me and demanding. And then when Humans of New York happened, there was a guilt imposed upon me because I still said, I'm done and I get it, but I can't do this anymore. Mm-hmm. And folks were like, well, if you leave now, it's going to be because you have become the celebrity that you're forgetting about the kids.
Wow.
And I was like, wow. My counterparts, I've seen some of them work 2 years in education as a teacher, write books, have movies, have all the things. Mm-hmm. And no one is sitting here saying to them, they have to die on this cross. Mm. But again, the imposition disease, I got guilted and I felt like I don't want my kids to feel like they're not important. Mm-hmm. I don't want them to feel like I use this opportunity to abandon them. They've dealt with that so much. I don't want my team to feel like I thought I was better than them. And this is a team effort. So I stayed, you know, and people just don't know that. And then as the years continue, you know, God will tell you it's time to move. But if you overstay your welcome, things will happen that may not be in your favor.
Yeah.
And so what ended up happening is I got progressively worse. Mm. And the attacks came even higher. And what's crazy is that when I would tell people what was happening, mm-hmm. they would look at me like I was crazy. Like, you just saying that. And I was like, no, y'all don't understand what I go through. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Because we don't think of schools being as a place where bullying happens against adults. We don't think of it as a place where you're really targeted. Mm-hmm. You know, it's supposed to be a happy place. Mm-hmm. Kids are excited. And I'm like, no, it's like any other working environment. It can be toxic.
Mm-hmm.
And it remains toxic when no one speaks up on your behalf. And then you have to deal with the ramifications of those individuals' actions.
Wow. So you got all this this attention, this media attention, and you are being held in such high regard from, you know, people around the world. You know, you met the Obamas, you spoke at Black Girls Rock, you did all of these wonderful things, but in your arena, you're being crucified, you know, mm-hmm. for doing, you know, everything that you did to help these students. I don't like when people are guilted into doing something because we get inside of our own heads. You knew that it was time for you to move because I believe that we are all on assignment, right?
Yes.
Because that's mm-hmm. how I see myself too. You're on an assignment and your assignment was up, but because of what people would think, right?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, they're going to think, oh, she got all this attention. Now she's this celebrity principal. Oh, you know, now she's moving on. And even though you knew that it was time for you to move on, because that was the natural progression of things,
yeah.
you know, that's how God was moving at that particular time. You stayed, you know, you paid the price with your health.
Mm-hmm.
You know, unfortunately. So you open a school to close a prison. You know, so talk about how you were forced to resign because you just couldn't do it anymore.
I couldn't sustain it. Well, like I shared, I did develop kidney disease and, mm-hmm. you know, again, God, because mm-hmm. everything else I had fought through, I would still show up at work. I take whatever medication. When you develop kidney disease where there's blood in your urine every day, it's going to make you pause and say, I can't go to work.
Mm.
Like, there's no way I can go to work.
Right.
And it was the first time that my body fully rested and I didn't know how extraordinarily tired I was. And so for the first time I slept for 12, 14 hours straight. And I remember learning how to go to yoga. You know, I had yoga in my school for my staff and I had done yoga, but I never, like, after yoga, you're supposed to go lay down, just mm-hmm. take it easy.
Mm-hmm.
I would go back to work. Like, literally yoga was happening in one of our rooms, our gym. Mm-hmm. And then I would go right back to work. So it was counterintuitive. Mm-hmm. When I finally took a class that I paid, you know, per day, per hour,
mm-hmm.
I was like, oh, this is what yoga is supposed to be and what it's supposed to feel like. And then I learned meditation. Like, I was doing it with my staff, but I never was actually in a place of meditating for myself.
Mm-hmm.
So I had to, the illness forced me to sit, but I never took days off, right? The only time I was not at work is that I was somewhere talking about my work.
Mm-hmm.
Right? That's how it was.
Mm-hmm.
I had accrued 156 days. Which was the equivalent of 7 months.
Wow.
When I got sick, I didn't know that you have to exhaust all of your days first. Because like when I worked for corporate,
mm-hmm.
if you needed time off because of any illness, you go into what's called short-term disability. You still get paid. You're not exhausting your days. But in education, you exhaust all your days first.
Mm.
So I would have to submit paperwork. My doctors would have to explain what's going on. They would have to send my labs, everything. When it was my 156 days and the Department of Education is approving.
Mm-hmm.
I had so much complications from the steroids that they said I needed to do a medical procedure because at this point I was going for physical therapy. I couldn't even mm-hmm. walk well. Mm-hmm. All these things was happening. And so the hospital contacted me and said, you don't have medical insurance. And I was like, what are y'all talking about? So I called the Department of Education and I told them, my time had to be extended. And they said, oh, well, you've been separated from payroll. And I was like, how did I get separated from payroll? Oh, you don't have any more days left. So nobody wants to contact me and tell me that. So they said, what you can do is apply for a medical sabbatical. What that means is you would only get 60% of your paycheck and you would get 6 months, but you would owe the Department of Education a year. I said, so I'm getting a portion of my salary and then I owe you double the time. I don't even understand how that works. They were like, well, that's how it works. But you have to go through your union. So I went through my union. I filled out the paperwork and it's submitted to the Department of Education. And they turned around and said, we're not approving this. And I was like, how is this possible? And they were like, we don't feel that your illness requires you to have, you know, pay or anything like that. You can go out on FMLA. So they put me on FMLA, but they was not going to provide me with medical insurance. Thank God I had a union to provide me for medical insurance. And the reason why I'm sharing that is because there's so many of us who dedicate our lives to our positions. And there's so many of us who get into a place of you're not well, but you won't take the day off. Right? I was forced to have to be home. And I had put my life on the line and I shared that I was at work Monday through Sunday. And every hour that I worked over my contracted time, I never asked for a dime extra. I never got paid overtime because I felt like the rewards was my kids being successful. So now I'm sick and you're telling me I got to ask for a medical sabbatical. You're going to give me less than what I'm worth. But then you still have the audacity to say, we're not going to approve you.
Wow.
So from January 2020, all the way to the day that I resigned, July 1st, I didn't get paid. Remember, y'all, this is the time of COVID. So in March, COVID happens, right? I'm actually healing from surgery. And we were on a call. I jumped on this call about, you know, the pandemic and schools being shut down. And they thought it was going to be shut down for 2 weeks. And I was like, it's a pandemic. We're going to be shut down for longer than that. And they laughed about it. The powers that be. So I went into my school knowing I wasn't supposed to, knowing I had underlying health issues and my mother was in her 70s. But again, putting my life on the line because guess what? They didn't care about our kids. They didn't care about the gaps that was going to happen as a result of this. They didn't care if they didn't have books or computers to be online. I got with my team. I showed up because I wanted them to know I'm in this with y'all. We're going to figure this out. We came up with a master plan. We got every one of our kids online. My teachers taught live every single day. They were so phenomenal, right? We provided mental health services. We did a 3-day work week for our staff and they can choose to work on Mondays. And on Fridays was mental health, professional development and game day. Cause I wasn't playing with their lives. Okay. I kind of said, y'all screwed me. I'm not doing nothing. But again, I'm called for a higher power to do this work. So I showed up. And so when it was time for me to go to the hospital and get my blood drawn because it was a COVID hospital and I couldn't go up until June, the doctor said, what are you doing? Are you fasting? And I said, fasting? No, I'm not fasting. He was like, your labs look like they're regressing. I said, you know what happens? I wake up in the morning, take a shower, then I get back, I get online. He's like, so what do you eat it? Oh, I don't know, like later on in the day. You going to the bathroom like you're supposed to? I mean, when I remember, he was like, so Nadia, let's talk about this. I thought it was a joke when you said the stress of your job, but you're literally on home at home in the middle of a pandemic on a medical leave and you're showing the same symptoms that you got you into the situation. You got three choices, dialysis, kidney replacement, or you're going to die early. One of the three. And I said, wait, what? He was like, that's it. And I thought about, I was working for an entity that didn't care that my daughter's in college and I paid for her tuition in full. I'm working for an entity who didn't care that because I'm sick is because of the hard work that I put into this and y'all haven't supported me, right? How do I, as a Black woman, show up for my Black daughter and tell her that she needs to choose herself and I'm not choosing me? And then this was coming off of George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, Ahmaud Arbery and Rashad Brooks, all of these people whose lives were being taken. And there was no acknowledgement for how we were feeling, still having to show up online to support these kids. I said, you know what? I don't want to DIE for the DOE. Because nobody is going to be able to explain to my daughter or my mother how they have to bury me. You're already showing me who you are. So I made that executive decision, leaving the school that I opened, a place of that had, you know, brought me so much joy. I know that there was a time that I had to leave, but God also decided, like, that's it. You have done all that you can. And so, you know, I share that because I want folks to know, like, this isn't for you to leave where you're at, but to be aware.
Yeah, but you resigned as an act of self-preservation.
Yep, I mean, absolutely.
Literally, your life was on the line.
Yes.
And you had to walk away from something that was so close to your heart. You know, so skipping ahead a little bit, you were banned from the campus after visiting with a former student. Talk about that and the lesson that you take away from that experience.
So I was banned. It's quote unquote banned. It's not an official ban.
Yes.
And I want to say that because I want folks to understand. I did open the school. It was approved by the New York City Department of Education. Once I left that school, it becomes the property of the Department of Education, right? Mm-hmm. But everything about it, the intellectual property behind it is me, right? Mm-hmm. What it's become now is I'm not claiming, but what it was me. Essentially, I had a successor who was my assistant principal, who became the principal, but the Department of Education imposed vaccine mandates that had a tremendous impact on our staff. There were people who chose not to get the vaccine, and rightfully so, they had that decision to make. So that impacted our leadership team as well as our teaching team. So as a result, they put in a temporary principal, you know, an interim acting principal. They put two in. One didn't work out. They put a second one in who, you know, from my understanding, did not have leadership experience, had worked maybe a couple of months as an assistant principal, but never to the capacity of a principal, did not understand the fundamentals of Mott Hall, why it was created, the vision, the mission, and all of the systems that we had in place. This person went in thinking it was a temporary, you know, situation, but still, if you go into Rome, you need to learn about the language and the culture before you think that you're going to impose yourself, right?
That's right.
And so essentially what started to happen is the staff felt unsafe by that person's behaviors. They felt that they were being targeted. The scholars were no longer being held accountable for their actions. And so when children are acting in a way that it is unsafe, it could impact the adult's license and their livelihood. If you speak to them a certain way, or if you get frustrated and you inadvertently, you know, say or do something, it could be your livelihood. So staff felt like they weren't being protected, and the mental health provider that I had since 2010 had not been paid from November up until March. And so I literally was receiving text messages, FaceTime calls, running the gamut of staff members who were literally saying, this is not the school that you open. Everything is burning around us. And so I was asked, because I was literally in Texas at South by Southwest EDU, a former staff member said to me, is there anything you can tell me to get through this? And, you know, I called her and she says, you know, Mr. Jenkins isn't coming back. And he was the mental health provider. And I was like, why not? She was like, because he's not getting paid. And I was going to stop into New York before I came back to Georgia. And I made the final decision to go to the school on a Sunday night when I had arrived in New York. And I decided I was just going to go, you know, to support the staff and to bring them a little pick me up gift, all of them, because I usually would do it in March because March Madness. And then also just to talk to the principal and present her with something for herself, as I do with my principals that I coach. And I felt we had a really great conversation. She was welcoming. I signed in and I talked to her about the school, the vision, and why this mental health provider was there, why, you know, you don't ask him for. So part of the issue was not only was she not paying him, but she was also asking him to provide her with the names of people who were seeing him and the times that he was seeing him, which was a breach of HIPAA violations. Right. And he was like, no, it's a mental health confidentiality. I can't do that. And then she basically said, you don't give me that. I can't pay you if I don't have a list of people. And I said to her, in all the years that I've done this, mm-hmm. I give the accounts payable our organization list. Mm-hmm. That's all they need. Mm-hmm. Because all they need to see is who is in the school that would get services, not who is actually getting the services.
Right.
But it was more about the control of seeing who was talking to him about certain things and wanted to know if anything was said about the school or her. And so I thought everything was fine, but I followed up with an email to her about things that I saw that was concerning, the fact that children were cursing out the secretary and not being in class, all the things that is not what Motho was made for. Yeah. She never responded. I also sent an email to the staff members who worked for me mm-hmm. and thanked them for their services and told them that, you know, I did see that the culture had changed and it wasn't something that I had ever expected or wanted to happen to the school. But, you know, they were the change agents. They were the ones who were disrupting the school to prison pipeline and depositing seeds. And they had to be mm-hmm. reminded of that. Mm-hmm. And so I wanted to charge them with understanding this person doesn't know, but you do know what you're expected to do. Mm-hmm. And I said, and this is just part of the Department of Education. They do what they do. This is how it is. And someone who wasn't part of my whole could never understand how to disrupt mm-hmm. or challenge mediocrity. And so what happened was, of course, when it comes out in the press, they took two sentences out of an entire email mm-hmm. and spoke more about what I was questioning or criticizing the principal, but I was really saying to the staff, you all know what it means to be part of Mott Hall because you mm-hmm. know the mission and vision, mm-hmm. right? She wouldn't know this. So you have to be the ones to step up. But as it would happen, it was used in a way that was disparaging. Right. Mm-hmm. And so I followed up a second time. I didn't go to the school to visit the school. I went for a documentary. I had been mentoring a supermodel, Ebony Davis, who mm-hmm. created a nonprofit for young Black women, 18 to 24, to take them to Ghana for 14 days. Mm-hmm. And one of my former scholars, who as a survivor of ovarian cancer from the time she was 16, went on the trip. Mm-hmm. And so it was a documentary to show the intergenerational connections, but also how the school was part of that connection. Mm-hmm. Laquana said, she asked about teachers who were no longer there. Many of them had left because of this principal in the middle of the year. Mm-hmm. But one of her teachers was her math teacher who was still there. And I said, it's lunchtime. We can go, but we cannot stay long because there's a lot going on. You know, the school is different. Mm-hmm. We went up for maybe 25, 30 minutes. We saw the principal. The principal was introduced to Laquana. They talked about the principal being from Nigeria, Laquana going to Ghana. It was all good. She uh-huh. saw her teacher. I'm leaving out. And here's the superintendent saying to me, I'm banned. Now, this is not the superintendent I had a good relationship with. We had our issues. And it was unfortunate because it was done on the first floor, which was very busy. Our school is on the third floor. I was told immediately, she said, I'm actually here to see you, because she approached me and I was like, oh. And she's like, I'm actually here to see you. You know, your presence creates tension. Mm-hmm. And I was so taken aback by that. She said, you know, I understand that you are coaching and you're mentoring people and you still provide support to the school. But the principal feels really uncomfortable with you coming, and given the climate of things, it's just best that you don't come back. So you're not welcome to come back to the school. You know, I thought to myself, like, I can't believe the superintendent and deputy superintendent have to come all the way over here, especially after the day before there was a shooting on the train. Mm-hmm. That, you know, in New York City, I'm not a threat like that. Mm-hmm. Someone could have texted me. Someone could have called me even after the first time I came to the school. Now I'm made to feel like I am somehow threatening to a space of which I had been asked in the previous times to come because people felt like they were at their last leg. Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. And then to do it in front of my scholar. Right. Mm-hmm. So two Black women now approach me in front of myself and my scholar. What is the image that she's seeing in terms of how we interact, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. And the fact that when she was upstairs with me, there was no issue. So, you know, the press got wind of it. And then it was like, oh, she's being investigated for unauthorized visits. And then the language that they use, unauthorized, sounds like criminal activity. Yeah. So now I'm being criminalized by being in a school that I opened. And many people was like, why would you go back? How many times have teachers gone back to the schools or kids gone back to the schools that they've been at? Like, it's never been an issue. Mm-hmm. But no one saw that as a problem. And unfortunately, the only ones who were affected are the children, because those who know me and the families who know me when they saw the story, mm-hmm. and even the teachers felt like if they could do that to her, there's nothing we can say. Yeah. And it was just sending a bigger message, like, we will come for whoever, and we will destroy whoever we feel like destroying. But here's the difference. Again, I'm a child of God. And, you know, there is no question about my intent. Mm-hmm. You know, and what I've learned from that is, one, when your assignment is over, don't go back.
Yes, I know.
That's, you know, like, I had good intentions, but the assignment was over. Mm-hmm. When God opened up the Red Sea and told Moses to go with the Israelites, and they was like, no, we want to go back to Pharaoh. The, mm-hmm. Listen, the parting of the Red Sea, when it closed back, you ain't supposed to go back.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. You have to just be reminded that what you do, what you deposit at the time that you deposit was a purpose for that day and time and that moment. And even through it, there's still grace and mercy, right? Because someone else could have easily been destroyed by that story. Mm-hmm. And there have been people who have questions, like, or have not, you know, crisis brings out character. You realize all these people who in the past was all about the shenanigans. When something like this is happening, no one is calling you to get the actual story. No one is, you know, a lot of these people aren't supporting you. So out of it, let me tell you something. Mm-hmm. What should have broke me just made me smarter. Mm-hmm. Because the elevation that God has in store for me, many of those folks don't need to be in my stratosphere. And it's not me putting myself ahead, but you don't know how harmful people are or their intentions, mm-hmm. or how much they really believe in you. Crisis will bring out the character of others.
Yes. Now, you also said something that really resonated with me. Now, you learned a lot about people and that you have a deeper discernment now. And I think that does come with age too. Mm-hmm. But you say you hear what people say and you watch what they do.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
You hear what people say and you watch what they do. You credit God for bringing you through that time. Does your faith still guide you today?
It does. Even when I'm like, I got to take a pause. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, it's not easy. You know, it's not easy when you feel like you have to bear a cross. But I also have to look back on my life and recognize that everything I've been through has been purposed for something greater. Mm-hmm. Right. And it's by His divine timing and His intervention and His purpose that I am who I am. I feel like when I am not as connected to Him, I am lost. I'm feeling like I don't know what I'm supposed to do. And I also know that sometimes it calls you to be patient and to be still, mm-hmm. right? And examine, who are you spending most of your time with? And what are you spending most of your time investing in? Mm-hmm. And sometimes He calls us to be closer to Him, because He has to remind you, you know, man is man. He is not perfect. But He's never failed me. Mm. He's never failed me. So even as I am in this space of a pause, because I am in a place of, what is my purpose? As much as I have done so much, there is right now, I'm in a place of, what is truly my purpose? Mm-hmm. He has called me to be still. And He has called me. I was able to travel. I literally just got back from Switzerland. And, you know, while I was on the Swiss Alps, right? Mm-hmm. And I don't say this boastfully, because one, I sat and tears came to my eyes. I'm a girl from Brooklyn. Mm-hmm. I'm on this trip with predominantly people who are not of color. Mm-hmm. Right? I'm looking around and I'm like, but it's only by God's grace that I'm here. Mm-hmm. And part of it is, you have to show that the same way you help walk children across the bridge, you need to show people that they deserve to be here as well. Mm. Right. Yeah. And there was such peace there. Right. There was so, like, there was peace. And I was like, yo, people literally can see this view every day, and they don't have stress, and they're not trying to run amok. Everything is rush, 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 rush. They literally take in every moment. Mm-hmm. And so I took in every moment possible. And so I know He said, you've done a lot and you just need to pause. Yeah. And it might feel like it's tough times, but I got you. So I'm just trusting. Yeah. I'm just trusting.
Well, obviously, you know, because currently you have a podcast and it's called Detention with Dr. Nadia Lopez.
Yes.
Disruptors and Rebels Only.
Yeah.
So how did you come up with that name? And what's your why for doing this podcast?
I came up with the podcast because I felt like there's a lot that happens in education that people don't talk about.
Mm-hmm.
And not to say, because I don't listen to every education podcast. I want to be honest, I don't listen to a lot of them.
Mm-hmm.
I listen to podcasts like yours where Black women are being amplified, talking mm-hmm. about finances and entrepreneurship, right? But mm-hmm. when it comes to education, those that I'm hearing, sometimes they come from a space of teachers talking, which mm-hmm. is all well and good, but there are things that happen on an administrative level that teachers don't understand. And there are things happening on a national, international level. And what happens in education is that we often stay in our box of where we feel most comfortable. Mm-hmm. And we engage in that space when there's so many moving parts. And I find that a lot of times people say just enough, but they're not willing to go step toe to toe because you don't want to burn bridges to opportunities.
Mm-hmm.
But my thing is, what is the opportunity that you will be burning bridges if it's not aligned to who you truly are?
Yes.
And there are things that we don't know that's happening. So I speak to a lot of educators who have no idea about what the budget really looks like, have no idea about how policies are really created, mm-hmm. but you're in this profession. Mm-hmm. So all the things that have gotten me in trouble as an educator, I sat down with one of my best girlfriends who is co-founder with my company, Elevated. She was like, you know, it's like you always in detention. Like, that's the kind of name you need. And I was like, and that's the name. I was like, Detention for Disruptors and Rebels. And she was like, and that it is. And I said, that's it.
Yeah.
And it just stuck. And I get great joy out of having conversations, bringing up points that people are like, I'm so glad you talked about that. But just creating that platform where I don't have to ask permission.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's powerful. So I know that you said you're in a place right now where you're just trying to listen and hear from God. Mm-hmm. What do you think is next for you? Do you have anything on the horizon that you want to do?
Well, right now, at this very moment, what I am doing is I'm coaching. So I offer coaching to leaders or those who are aspiring into leadership mm-hmm. To help them through one, my rec room, which is redefining education cohort. I thought it was really important to have women of color specifically come together in a space that's safe for them to share experiences, but also to get strategies that will help them navigate all that they have to do, but mm-hmm. also take care of themselves, because that is rooted in self-care, self-preservation. And then there's one-on-one coaching that I do for 6 months. Mm-hmm. And then there's consulting. I do a lot of consulting with school districts around, you know, building efficacy or addressing school culture. Whatever seems to be the issue, we'll unpack and then come up with a strategy to support their schools. But ultimately, I love speaking. I've started back to my keynote speaking. I've been on hiatus for a while and pushing my books and my online courses. So there's a lot that I'm doing. But folks could definitely keep up with me on my social media platforms, LinkedIn, Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, @TheLopezEffect.
Mm-hmm.
And they could also see my website, which is at www.thelopezeffect.com.
Mm-hmm.
And if they want to reach out to me, they can reach out to me at Nadia, N-A-D-I-A, @TheLopezEffect.com.
Awesome. So a couple of questions that I ask everybody.
Sure.
What are some advantages of doing what you do at your age? And what are some challenges?
Oh, well, now that I'm an entrepreneur, the advantage is that, you know, you get to a place, like I told you, when you get to your 40s, you're like, there's a lot that you won't take. So not having a boss per se,
mm-hmm.
it's in line with where I'm at. However, the disadvantages is you have to hustle because that money is not going to just fall from the sky. Right.
Hello.
So the energy that I had when I was 20 or 30 to be like, hey, the hustle, I'm at 45. I'm like, I like doing this. Right. So that's the advantage and disadvantage of it.
Okay. Yeah. Well, what advice do you have for women over 40 who believe their best years are behind them?
Oh, honey. No, your best years are not behind you. I think that you should, one, find a new group of friends. Yes. And I only say that with love and respect, right? Mm-hmm. You have to find your tribe. You really have to find your tribe, the people who are going to uplift, motivate, and pour into you. My life is not easy. And I have a core group of folks who are my cheerleaders, and they recognize when I'm spiraling, or, you know, they check in with me and they love on me when I can't love myself. Mm-hmm. And so that comes with wisdom and age, mm-hmm. and being able to find that core group. And so I would say, you know, find your tribe. Step out and venture into spaces, whether it's online or in your local community, where you get to meet other people. Because part of it, my question is, like, who's inspiring you? Who's motivating you? I'm an Aquarius, so I have to be fed creatively. Like, I can't exist without creativity. Mm-hmm. And so that may be what they're experiencing. You just need a new place, a new space, a new friends, or new tribe.
Absolutely. Wonderful advice. Well, you've already shared your social media handles. I just want to thank you, Dr. Lopez, for sharing your 40 plus power with us today. This has been absolutely amazing. And, you know, you're a phenomenal human being, really.
Well, Jacqueline, thank you for sharing your platform with me. You are just as phenomenal. I thank you for creating spaces for us and recognizing us. And kudos to you, because I know it's not easy taking your time and placing your energy. Yeah, just take gentle care of yourself.
Oh, thank always. You so much. Thank you so much.
Dr. Lopez continues to advocate for the many students who have the odds stacked against them, as well as for the countless dedicated teachers who are on the front lines. Her unending fight to help scholars obtain a valuable education is far from over. You can catch her on her podcast, Detention with Dr. Lopez, for Disruptors and Rebels Only, on all major platforms. To find out more about Dr. Lopez, you may visit her website at www.thelopezeffect.com. For more information about the podcast, send inquiries to info@the40plusfiles.com. Don't forget to follow the podcast on Instagram at the40plusfiles. You can also follow my blog at www.wordyprofessor.com. Until next time, 40 plus phenoms, keep on shining.